Sustainability became a buzzword throughout every government department that I was aware of. What I think we have now is something that's very different, which is not that you should think about it, but that you should make it a priority, perhaps above some of the priorities that you have had previously. Governor of California, Arnold Schwarzenegger, complained that he was unable to get a solar power plant built in the Mojave Desert. And as he put it, if you can't build a power plant, a solar power plant in the Mojave Desert, where on earth can you build one?
Social justice and climate change have become central priorities across government, from Whitehall departments to regulators and even councils. The public sector equality duty requires all public authorities to promote equality in their day-to-day business, while the Climate Change Act mandates targets for carbon reduction across all tiers of government. Yet critics worry that this whole-of-government priorities approach risks imposing significant costs and reducing regulatory competence. Welcome back to the IEA podcast. My name is Matthew Lash, and I'm the IEA's Director of Public Policy and Communications. Each week, this podcast asks a tantalizing policy question. Today's question: should addressing climate and social justice be the priority? To discuss, I'm excited to be joined for the first time by Ian Murray, who's the Vice President for Strategy and Senior Fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He's an author of several best-selling books and countless reports and articles. As you'll see, he's originally from the United Kingdom, and he's also spent time working in the UK civil service. Welcome to the podcast.
It's great to be with you today, Matthew.
So I'm interested in unpacking this idea of a whole-of-government approach to an issue, because as we were discussing this before the podcast, we kind of realized that it's not exactly new. This idea that the government should have certain priorities that apply across different departments or certain issues you're trying to address. Perhaps most famously in the UK case, Tony Blair was obsessed with joint up government to address issues like crime and poverty. I'm wondering how the kind of new priorities kind of contrast that, the focus on social justice and climate change being just, I suppose, an evolution of a previous thought that governments should be have certain things that apply to all areas.
Yes, I mean, it's interesting that you, first of all, talk about an environmental issue, climate change. The first time I came across this was when I was working in the Department of Transport in the UK, and John Major, actually before Blair, came up with this idea of joined-up government, and part of his idea for joined-up government was that we should start taking the environment a bit more seriously, and therefore sustainability became a buzzword throughout every government department that I was aware of. So you have to think about, you know, when you were thinking about a new rail line for London, I worked on the predecessor to the new Elizabeth line, for instance. Yeah, we were thinking about sustainability throughout that project management process. What I think we have now is something that's very different, which is not that you should think about it, but that you should make it a priority, perhaps above some of the priorities that you have had previously. So you would think about climate change as the number one issue when you are thinking about a new rail line, rather than how many people can you move into and out of the centre of London during rush hour. So I think that's a real change in thinking.
You've spent some time thinking about and looking at this, particularly in the US context, where the Biden administration, I suppose not too different to the UK government, has set and put forward over recent years series of priorities that they expect from the Oval Office down to each individual regulator in the US system to be followed. I'm wondering if you can take us through some kind of examples of this phenomenon and how it operates.
Well, yes, the White House has sent out a bunch of different missives in various forms, executive orders, the most notable, about that government agencies need to be thinking about a variety of things. It's a bit of a smorgasbord, actually. So not just climate change, but also things like labor. How do we increase the number of union members in industries that are affected by your agency, that sort of thing. So you get to the position where the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, which is supposed to be the competition authority, is putting out rules on labor policy. where the Securities and Exchange Commission, which is supposed to be a soundness agency, is putting out rules on climate and a bunch of other things like this throughout the whole of U.S. government. And it's not just the presidential agencies, the executive agencies, but also the independent agencies, which are supposed to have, by their charters, supposed to be independent of presidential control, and yet they are still being made subject to these whole of government initiatives.
Yeah, it kind of strikes as very similar to the UK. Now, I'm not sure there's a good case study of perhaps Number 10 or Downing Street putting out an executive order about these topics, but certainly in practice, through existing laws like the ones I mentioned earlier, like the public sector equality duty, as well as regulators' own inclinations, are choosing to do something very similar. So the Financial Conduct Authority comes to mind here, where they've been talking about quotas for women and ethnic minorities on financial boards. You look at the Prudential Regulatory Authority, part of the Bank of England, have been talking quite a lot about climate risk. They've kind of grabbed onto these very similar political issues and tried to push them forward. I suppose the first essential question here comes, is this illegitimate? So is there something wrong with a public authority deciding that they want to focus on these issues? Perhaps in the US case, is there something wrong with the president saying, I would like my agencies that I am notionally meant to be responsible for in some way, perhaps not the independent ones, but ones that are more directly controlled by the president and the executive of the US government, to say, this is what I think the priority should be. I want you to consider these things as well.
Well, I think certainly with the independent agencies, that there is a really big constitutional question as to whether this is illegitimate. The independent agencies were set up in order to exercise quasi-judicial and quasi-legislative powers and not executive powers. Of course, that's changed over the years. They definitely exercise some executive powers. But the more they are drawn into this sort of ambit, the more you're going to have to question whether there is a legitimate constitutional role for an independent agency. And there are, in fact, cases before the courts at the moment. I think there is one that is going to the Supreme Court, which could decide, as a result of things like this, that independent agencies really have to be answerable to the president, and that would be a big constitutional change in the U.S. But when it comes to the agencies which everybody accepts that the president has control over, there then becomes an issue of what exactly is the priority of the agency. If the Department of Transportation is supposed to be about making sure that that Americans get around the country quickly, if the environment is actually now its number one priority, then the transportation the department isn't going to be about making sure that people are able to get around the country quickly. So you get to this the situation where certain policies are gumming up other policies. We see it in the CHIPS Act, for instance. The CHIPS Act was passed at the end of the last Congress in order to encourage more. It was a classic piece of industrial policy. Encourage more semiconductor plants being opened in the U.S. rather than in Taiwan and other places. But as part of the CHIPS Act, there were all sorts of other riders put onto it, which were essentially whole-of-government things. One of the important things that the CHIPS Act talks about is DEI policy. So in order to qualify for the very generous subsidies that the CHIPS Act authorized, you have to agree to some very stringent DEI rules. And this means that people just aren't applying for those subsidies because those rules are so stringent that it becomes really difficult to actually set up the plant in the first place. So we reach a situation where when a law is passed with a primary goal and a secondary goal, that secondary goal is making sure that the primary goal doesn't actually happen, And when that sort of thing is occurring, you have to think about whether this is a good approach to public policy or not.
It strikes me, another example of this, and when it comes to the financial sector, is when financial regulators start focusing on what are not clearly financial goals, let's say, addressing climate change, perhaps undermining their initial purpose, which is to ensure the safety and stability of financial institutions. So if you're encouraging banks to potentially make more risky loans because they could be good for the climate, or not make less risky loans because they could be bad for the climate, or by some assessment, whoever makes assessment is another issue altogether, you're potentially actually adding more financial stability. You're undermining your key purpose, and it's not necessarily consistent. I mean, and then at the same time, there's that democratic question about whether or not these financial regulators are the ones who should be responsible for climate change policy, or if trying to push that onto banks is something that is really should be a matter for the legislator, if so, through more efficient policy making. It does strike me, though, that there might be certain cases where it could be almost justified, or maybe I'd wrongly have more sympathy for it, because I think there is a problem with the way regulators act. So the UK government's talked about putting a growth duty, like an additional duty, onto some regulators, so that when they're making their policy, they have to consider economic growth as one of the goals. It does seem to me a lot of regulatory activity can undermine economic growth, and it might not necessarily be bad if they're thinking about the potential, I suppose, cost-benefits analysis of when they impose kind of regulatory requirements, that they, if they impose too much regulatory requirement, could undermine the growth of the industry or the growth of the economy at large. I'm wondering how you take that as an example of some, perhaps, I don't know, but whether it's a more justified or a different form of whole of government priority.
But when you look at, you raise the example of financial regulators becoming climate regulators, in essence. When you look at the actual risks involved to the material soundness of companies from climate risk, you realize that it's not even in the top 10 of risks, and most of the rest of that top 10 aren't actually currently subject to rules. So there are misplaced priorities here. You know, John Cochrane, former CEA member, who writes a wonderful blog called "The Grumpy Economist." Mm. You know, he's torn apart the SEC's attempts to regulate on this on soundness grounds alone. So the actual mission of the SEC is really being undermined by this sort of thing. But you know, when you talk about the growth targets and so on, there's something our Central American colleagues are looking at, which is that they've become resigned to the idea that ESG is going to be part of Central American government's policies going forward. So they've just proposed expanding it to ESG plus F, environmental, social, governance, and freedom. Hmm. You know, so the idea would be that you look not just at the at environmental, social, and government implications of a policy, but you also look at the what it really means for people's freedom. And I think if we are going to go down this road, then something like that really needs to be considered. You know, let's add in some more issues that are worthy of people's attention. And, you know, human liberty is very much worthy of people's attention.
Yeah, I suppose what would worry me about, and in fact what worries me even about the growth duty, is that it just hands over the dealing with the contradictions or the tensions or the trade-offs to the regulator. It almost reduces any democratic accountability. And there's a lot of cases where legislators and governments attempted to do this. So recently I've been working quite a lot on online safety legislation, where the government is creating duties on a regulator and on companies to both protect free speech and undertake more extreme content moderation. And it's in some ways, the legislator was aware of the contradiction here. That's why they're putting both of those duties into the law. They just don't want to have to deal with it themselves. And it seems like you're handing power over to a regulator to basically deal with all these different contradictions that might arise. And you're losing kind of any kind of meaningful sense of democratic accountability, since the regulator can just do whatever the heck it wants, because they can be, at different times, they can just claim to be prioritizing different things or to have made the trade-off or balance in some specific way.
Yeah. The one thing that is absolutely key, and we see this in the American experience time and time again, is that regulators have to be accountable. There was something called Operation Choke Point towards the end of the Obama administration, where essentially the Obama administration was trying to put certain industries out of business, despite Congress not legislating against them, despite in some cases the Supreme Court saying you have a constitutional right to this business, pornography. But they were attempting to use financial regulation to kill off online porn, payday lending, various other industries. There is an argument that these industries might be better if they were banned or curtailed in some way. But you have to do that through the democratic process. You have to go through actually make a law if you're going to try and ban an industry. You can't just do it by regulatory fiat. And so accountability was absolutely essential in making sure that Operation Choke Point was, if you pardon the expression, was strangled, and regulators were basically put back in their place. The House Oversight Committee, a wonderful legislator called Blaine Lukemire, showed a lot of leadership on this and took it directly to the heads of the various agencies. And there was the sort of constitutional long stop of legal action, which in the end was settled by the Trump administration. So that never actually came to court. But all of these forms of accountability and oversight are essential. And something that really worries me about the way the UK constitution is going is this idea that regulators are somehow Olympian and will always produce the best results, and you don't need democratic oversight of regulators. That's a really dangerous road the UK is going down.
Well, it seems like it's almost a practical consequence of the fact that the legislator has given the executive so much power and then wraps that up in regulators and across so many different complex parts of society. And therefore, the legislator is like lost its, like, doesn't have the expertise, let alone the time to possibly hold account the kind of beast it is created over time. There's literally very little capacity and very few mechanisms to hold them to account. Perhaps a particularly poignant recent example of this was the Post Office, a publicly owned organization that was using state powers for this massive miscarriage of justice over several decades, and no one was meaningfully holding them to account for such a long period of time. But it was just one of many things the government did. No one was particularly interested or focused on the Post Office. It wasn't normally that controversial, even that interesting. So the consequence of all that expansive role of the state is that it can't really hold anyone to account.
Yeah, this isn't actually a new problem. Lord Hewitt, who was the former Chief Justice, Lord Chief Justice of England and Wales, wrote a book back in 1929 called The New Despotism, where he complained that powers were being taken out of their rightful place in Parliament and being given to ministers. Ministers have now taken those powers and delegated them to regulators. Regulators are probably going to want to delegate those powers further, deputizing them to corporations or companies. It's an issue that really needs to be taken under control. There needs to be a theory of how regulation fits in the British Constitution, and at the moment, I'm not sure there is one.
There seems to be some practical issues here, even for the regulators themselves. And I think perhaps this is most prominent in the planning space, where it's literally almost impossible, I shouldn't say exactly impossible, but extremely difficult to get approvals to do pretty much any kind of major piece of infrastructure, including ironically green infrastructure. So if you're seeking out permission to build a solar power plant, for example, in the UK, and the kind of environmental assessments you have to go through will take up literally thousands and thousands of pages. Same if you want to build a rail link, which again is meant to be obviously much better for the environment to have people on the railways and not driving individual cars. So you can't even get the kind of like basics done that would be necessary to improve the environment and address climate change because of all the kind of regulatory requirements that we now expect. And because of particularly the process of judicial review, they have to make a regulator has to make sure every box is ticked so that they don't screw up something on the process grounds and have the decision thrown out.
It's exactly the same in the US. When he was governor of California, Arnold Schwarzenegger complained that he was unable to get a solar power plant built in the Mojave Desert. And as he put it, if you can't build a power plant, a solar power plant in the Mojave Desert, where on earth can you build one? This problem is actually being recognized by some people, even those who are naturally sympathetic to the environmental left in the Democrat Party. There's a large group of people who I call supply side progressives. Who are realizing that you can't get anything built anywhere because of NEPA, the National Environmental Planning Act that was passed in 1970 and has just metastasized over the years. There is a push for permitting reform, but that is being opposed point blank by the environmental groups. So when the environmental groups are opposing it, there's very little chance of it actually getting through Congress. There was an attempt in the Inflation Reduction Act. Joe Manchin, the senator from West Virginia, brokered a deal because he's very much in favor of energy projects of all sorts. So he brokered a deal, but it got watered down so much that the permitting reform that was touted as part of the Inflation Reduction Act, it really isn't terribly meaningful, but I think there is potential here that free market forces and the supply side progressives can actually team up and get permitting reform done, if not at the federal level first, at state level. And I think there's great opportunity for that. Pennsylvania, which is run by a moderate Democrat, Governor Shapiro there. There's scope for permitting reform in Pennsylvania. There's scope for permitting reform in a bunch of other states, and those are the laboratories of democracy in the U.S. Constitution. If we can see permitting reform actually work in those states, then we might actually be able to get it passed at the federal level. So there's a bit of hope for you.
Well, hopefully, providing some inspiration for planet reform in the UK as well. I mean, it strikes me talking about the role of environmental groups in opposing policies that are good for the environment. There's no better classic example than anti-nuclear activism, which if we hadn't basically stymied the nuclear industry with so much extraordinary, often, quote-unquote, environmental or safety regulation pushed by some of the environmental groups, perhaps we could already have clean and cheap energy for everyone.
Indeed. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission in the United States was founded, I think, in either the late 70s or early 80s. It has approved one reactor in all its time. It's basically an anti-nuclear energy regulator.
So I kind of want, I suppose, some concluding thoughts. So one example you've given is some like permitting reform that could smoothen out a regulatory process. But it seems like there's a broader and deeper issue here, which we've been talking about when it comes to the kind of whole of government priorities. What do you think the steps can be taken to try to, I suppose, clean up the regulatory system and the way regulators operate to make them, I suppose, more, everything we want, more effective and focused in terms of achieving their goals, being able to do make decisions in a relatively swift and straightforward but robust manner, without getting, I suppose, distracted by other issues in the process?
Well, I think we've got to look at rules about rules, as the saying goes. One thing that we had a lot of success with during, I hate to mention this, but during the Trump administration, was with rules about guidance. When you look at how regulation works, the you start off with the law that authorizes the regulation. Then you have regulations which in the US have to go through something called the Administrative Procedure Act. So there's notice, comment, consultation, basically. And the final rules are supposed to reflect that consultation process. But then you get to the stage of guidance, which is circulars, legal interpretations. During the Obama administration, even blog posts were a form of guidance. And if you as a regulated entity have to search for all this guidance on how the regulation is actually going to be applied. So we call this, at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, we call this regulatory dark matter.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's a huge amount. It's very much the vast majority of regulation is this dark matter. So during the Trump administration, we persuaded agencies to pass FROGs, as we call them, federal rules on guidance, and these rules basically set out, you know, how guidance was to be formulated and applied, and most importantly, disseminated to the public. So the agency set up guidance portals so that you, as a regulated entity, could actually go to the department's website, find out what all the guidance was on the regulations that affected you. When the Biden administration came in, they stomped those frogs. They got rid of the federal rules on guidance. They closed down the guidance portals, which tells you, I think, a lot about how the Biden administration views regulation. But this sort of transparency is, I think, our best hope when it comes to getting responsible regulation to become the norm.
I'd love to see something similar in the UK. Very similar issue indeed. The fact that regulators have no central repository of of information for the people that are expected to follow it, and they're creating more and more every single day. Ian Murray from the Competitive Enterprise Institute, thanks so much for joining the IEA podcast. It's been a pleasure to have this conversation with you about a fascinating emerging topic. For those who are enjoying this podcast, please do subscribe on your chosen podcast provider if you'd like to learn more about the IEA's work, including our scrutiny of regulators and regulation. And do just visit the IEA's website at iea.org.uk.